And now, coming to you live from the Grisham Room, high above the Coot Street Motel 6, it's Jonathan Schrein and Gary K. Wolf with very special guest Arkady Martin on the Coot Street Podcast!
And we're back, and we're talking to Arkady Martin, who is a fellow academic, so I want to talk a little bit about that. But thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for A Memory Called Empire and A Desolation Called Peace. And the first thing is, are we going to have that formula for any future titles?
Oh, God. First of all, hi. And that's the first thing I say on your podcast. Maybe. I would love to be able to pull it off. And of course, now I have to tell you the story of how I came up with them. The second one is the one I got first, actually, because I had spent absolutely forever with no title for Memory the entire time I was writing it. It was called Mahit and the City, which was functionally true, but not very good. And then during the period where I was like, why did I decide to write a novel? This is a terrible idea. I am a short story writer. What on earth am I doing to myself? It was called The Perils of Mahit. I like The Perils of Pauline.
Pauline, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was called More Perfect World, which I stole from the other epigraph that is in the front of it, the Montpensant epigraph. And that one came from Elizabeth Baer, who found it for me. And that's what I submitted it to agents under. That lasted literally the space of time between submittal and getting an agent. It was sold under, I think we called it The Imago Emperor briefly, all very John Scalzi, that one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that is how I sold the book. And immediately upon selling the book, it was, that's not the title. And then I didn't know. And I didn't know for quite some time. I mean, I liken the experience to assaulting castle tour marketing with water balloons. I would come up with titles. I would think they were brilliant or functional, or this one will make the marketing people happy. And I would send them off. They would come back to me with the marketing team and or my editor and or my agent going, I guess, maybe. So,
well, the desolation comes from Tacitus, doesn't it?
Yes. So I was reading Tacitus in a bar in Prague, which is my favorite way to tell this. I was rereading Tacitus in a bar in Prague. I had gone to one of the last conferences I did when I was a postdoc in Sweden. I'd actually moved back to the States already, but I was there to do a conference on narratology. And one of the other participants at the conference was doing a presentation on Tacitus, so I was rereading it and came on that line again, and I've loved that line forever. Rome makes a desert and calls it peace. And just had this moment of, oh, well, that's the title for book two then. And sort of sneakily texted my editor from Prague, can I have this title for book two? And she was like, yeah, can you make one for book one out of that?
Okay.
To get the same kind of rhythm to it, I guess.
And so maybe I can pull it off again. Maybe.
Did coming up with the title from Memory change how you felt about it? Because sometimes these things seem seamless after the fact.
Not exactly. It felt right, though, which none of the other experimental titles had ever.
Yeah.
It was the one thing I've ever written that, to me, just did not have a title. And then it did, and it was clearly the title it should have.
It seems inevitable once you've read the book, and it falls into place beautifully, as though the title were sort of set up for all the pieces to fall into place at the end of the book, which is your way of tricking us into reading it the way you wanted us to read it, isn't it?
Well, maybe, yes. I will admit to being an incredibly manipulative writer on purpose. I mean, I think all writers are, in a way. But I definitely think a great deal about what I want the reader experience to be and at how that experience changes at different points in the book.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing to do and also to read when I'm reading myself is to have a book end and sort of reassemble itself now with the knowledge of the entire arc, this kind of moment of gestalt where the whole thing makes sense. And sometimes that is the whole thing makes sense and it's different than you thought.
Yeah. I guess that one of the things is with title and cover and package and everything, which is done brilliantly with Memory, is it's that pre-feeding the reader with what they're going to expect, how they're going to feel about something. You know, it is the pre-community, the prologue before the book is the title and cover and look, so you know where you're going, I think.
This is why I argued as hard as I did for the accent color on the cover of Memory to be gold, not silver.
Ah,
okay. Which I also had to argue for. I was right, and I won, and this was like what... So I got very lucky with covers and feel like I have some sort of deal with the devil that I will surely pay for later. But the art was perfect from the get-go.
Yeah.
But apparently... science fiction is supposed to be silver and fantasy is supposed to be gold. That's how it is.
I
did not know that.
Me either.
It actually tracks if you go and like walk up and down the aisles of a Barnes & Noble.
But isn't gold supposed to be imperial? But
greatly so.
That raises another issue about the title of Memory called Empire. And Jonathan and I were talking on a podcast maybe last week about history and science fiction versus history and fantasy. An empire is one of those loaded words. For some people, it clearly signals fantasy. It clearly signals the imaginary world building volume after volume. And for a certain age of science fiction readers, you think all the way back to Asimov. That, in other words, the idea of empires, galactic empires especially, was a very big deal in science fiction 70 years ago. And it seems that fantasy has co-opted the whole notion.
I think it's come back round again. I mean, if you look at what's out there right now, I'm certainly not the only one. And it's funny you say science fiction readers of a certain age, because that's what I started reading. I'm 36. Hmm. My father was a science fiction fan, is a science fiction fan. I got Foundation and Empire very, very early, probably earlier than I ought to have read it. I don't think I understood it when I read it. It was maybe 9, which is a bit young.
You could have understood it at 9.
Yeah, well, it worked when you're 9 because you don't get the parts that aren't there.
Yeah,
right.
Yes,
but it's also worth keeping in mind that Asimov was like 18 and 20 at the time. So,
see, this I don't actually know. This is the weirdness of my education in the field is that I've read a lot of the classics, but I don't know the deep history of the field.
Okay.
You
know?
Yeah,
but you did really because I'm not. I was going to say, you did mention in your Locus interview that setting something that far in the future and that distant in space effectively could have been a secondary world fantasy. In other words, there's no logical connection. We don't have to make a connection between our world and the world you've depicted.
Yes.
But the same thing could have been said about Le Guin's Hainish worlds, for that matter. So.
Yes. I mean, if you want to draw a line, there's a possible line you can draw. From Earth to Tixalan. I am agnostic on it completely. It could be 7,000 years from now. It could be the next universe over. Doesn't really matter.
Well, I was going to ask you, because I'm curious where science fiction begins for you, because Memory opens with what I think is a classic archetypal science fiction scene. It is somebody comes to Trantor. That's what it is at the very beginning, that sort of person from the sticks coming to the big city, the whole thing. So where does the science fiction begin for you? When did you start reading it? What do you feel you were responding to as you grew up with reading science fiction?
Well, I had it very, very young. Like I said, Asimov, and I started actually reading Asimov nonfiction because I was a tiny child obsessed with chemistry. Of course, I turned out to be a city planner and a historian and not a scientist at all. But I as a very, very small kid, I loved the history of physics. I loved atomic physics and all. And he wrote this book, The Atom. So I had read that.
Yes.
And I was a voracious reader, even at that size. And my father is a pulp science fiction fan, sort of the 60s, 70s. It was all over the house, paperbacks just left everywhere. And I would literally read anything that wasn't tied down or removed. So I went through a bunch of Zelazny. I went through a whole lot of strange collections that I can no longer remember who wrote the stories or if they were real. They're just floating there in my back brain. But for me, the sense of science fiction as something one read as science fiction, like an awareness of the genre, probably was a combination of the Foundation books as like a stage setting, Star Wars as a story hook, and then Dune. Mm-hmm. And Dune was when it blew wide open for me.
Oh, okay.
That was that's the road in, and I think I was maybe 10 or 11 then.
How far into the Dune series did you get?
All of the ones written by Frank.
Okay. That's the right answer.
And I loved both Dune Prime and Dune Messiah very much, and also have a deep and abiding and screwy affection for God Emperor.
Actually, it's interesting because that's really the spectrum that ultimately Memory sits on, isn't it? It is a spectrum that starts with Foundation, hits Dune, and arguably I would put is pretty heavily influenced by C.J. Cherry and the
Hugely
Down Below work.
Influenced by C.J. Cherry, but I found Cherry as an adult, so
okay,
that's a different way in. Sort of, I found Cherry as a late teenager. I read Citeen when I was almost 17 years old, which is the absolute perfect time to read a book that you're going to reread every 5 years for the rest of your life. I love that book. It's still a touchstone book for me. I think it's one of the real explorations of identity that exists in the field, and that we don't often address it in those terms as much as we should. But I mean, the direct antecedent of Memory is the Foreigner books. In fact, they are in some ways she did that, let's see if I can do it thing, which is why people think that I'm reacting off of Anne Leckie, which I'm not. Anne Leckie and I are both reacting off of Foreigner.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Hang on, does that mean there are 19 more Memory books coming?
God, no, there are not. There are probably at least two more, but they're not direct sequels.
Yep.
Because one of the things I don't want to do is, I'm not a reader of epic fantasy, nor am I a writer of epic fantasy style space opera. For me, the two books that exist right now are a complete arc. They go from a beginning to a close emotionally.
Yep.
There's at least one more book that is very close in chronology, but it has a very different focus. It's probably mm-hmm. the one I'll write next. And then I have a whole list of things I could do in the universe, because the universe is huge and I want to play with it forever.
Yeah.
Do you have characters from these novels that you want to revisit?
Yes. Most especially the baby emperor, Eight Antidote.
Yes. Okay, great. Also, that was my favorite character, by the way.
I love him. And you want to talk about Citeen. That is me doing Ariane Emery,
too. Okay, right.
Yeah.
I have not figured out what his book is yet, because there's several different books that could be his book.
Mm-hmm.
But his book is one of the ones I want to write very soon, because I think he deserves one that's his.
So you sit down to write Memory. It's the mid-20-teens, I assume, somewhere around about there. Mm-hmm. And you're going to talk about empire, about powers from without, with colonialism. What is your mindset in wanting to approach this of all things? I mean, this course, science fictional thing, we talk about science fiction and we talk about changes in perspective. We talk about inclusiveness and everything else. And you come to, you know, empire, which is this big thing and is historically very complicated and difficult. Where are you coming to with that, or coming from with that?
I came to it because of what I was doing as an academic, because I was obsessed with it, and because I'd been thinking about empire and how it distorted culture and how it fascinated the imperialized and the colonized at the same time as destroying what made them interesting and unique. I've been thinking about that since I was 21,
mm-hmm.
and obsessively, the way that one does if one writes a PhD. And then I was in the middle of this postdoc. I wrote the book from the period of time about 2 months after I got my PhD to about 6 months before I finished the postdoc I did in Sweden, which was mm-hmm. the last I did in that phase of that career.
Yeah.
So it was, in many ways, I was doing the academic version on one screen and the version where I put all of the way it made me feel on the other screen.
That raises the other issue about fantasy, because your academic work was basically on Byzantium and the Byzantine Empire, which itself is a source of all kinds of fantasies. There's Guy Gabriel Kay's Sorantium. In other words, it would have been so easy to take that material and simply turn it into I don't know what the term is, quasi-historical fantasy, alternate history fantasy, something along those lines.
Would be far too difficult. I know too much. That's the problem. I think people who write historical fiction, and especially people who write secret historical fiction, where they've added events, but the events have to stay the same, or they've found a jumping off point. I am in awe. The more I know about a time period, the less comfortable I feel writing in it. I'm currently doing some near future science fiction, and it is giving me the horrors for multiple reasons. I mean, I'm too close. How do you draw those lines? I could have written a version of Memory that was set in a quasi-historical late Byzantium. I would have felt very constrained by what I knew happened and by what I knew of the actual constraints on the empire. I'd have to break it somehow to have room for a story that someone else hadn't told or experienced. Science fiction in this way is enormously freeing for me.
Let me ask you a lazy, open-ended question, but it does tie in kind of thing. In 2020-21, why space opera, though? Do you think it still has vitality for story?
Why space opera? Because I love it. That's why. It's a lazy answer to the question, but I just enjoy it. It's got all the stuff I want to play with. And Memory was the first novel I ever managed to finish, so I had to give myself as many advantages as I could, including I have to be incredibly self-indulgent with it, because there's so many goddamn words to write.
How many times did you have to go over it to get the word?
I mean, in terms of how many edits did I do, or
how many, the most important point you went, there's my first draft, and that took this amount of time, and then there's the final version, and
So here's the terrible secret of me. I don't write drafts.
Ah. Okay.
I write the book, and then I fix the book, but it's not really another draft. It's an edit. It can be a really, really deep edit. And I mean, the one on Memory added 40,000 words. So yeah, but that required an editor and an edit letter. I didn't do that. For me, the book was done. Okay. And it was done enough to be sellable, apparently. But it was also only 95,000 words long, and functionally a Le Carré political thriller.
I was going to say, there's an espionage novel inside the novel. And that's one of the things that makes it.
What I wrote first.
Well, okay, fine. But broadly talking about two kinds of novelists, those that start out with 200,000 words and the editor makes it 90,000 words, or those that apparently start out with less and the editor says, you need to explain this, you need to have this connective tissue, you need to fill in this. But in terms of space opera, my sense is that A Memory is much less space opera-ish than A Desolation Called Peace. A Desolation Called Peace has aliens and has space battles and spaceships and tactical and strategic decisions to be made. The thing that I came away from Memory, the key word in that title for me was memory. That struck me as being really a novel about memory and about how all our memories are palimpsests of some sort.
Yes. I mean, it's a space opera by setting.
Yeah, by
setting. But I don't really think of it. Desolation is in the genre conversation with a lot of other space opera. Mm-hmm. Also in the genre conversation with a lot of military science fiction, which is a thing I love to read, sort of like airplane books, and always want them to be with the deep, nasty emotional consequences, and therefore decided to write one for me, which would have all the deep, nasty emotional consequences in and still have like soldier machinations, because they're really fun. But Memory is, I hate the term planetary romance, because I think it does not describe the thing that it purports to describe. But it is far more in that genre than it is in the quote-unquote space opera genre. But really, if I'm adding it to a collection of books, I think of it as political science fiction. It is about politics. It is about civilization-level existential questions and how they interact with personal existential questions. Mm.
Well, there's some fear. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. You go ahead.
Now I've forgotten what I was going to say. No, there's a sense of fear of assimilation as works at all kinds of levels in the novel, because obviously you have, how do you pronounce it? I keep wanting to say Liesel.
Liesel.
Liesel, okay. LaSalle is clearly an outpost that's in danger of losing its identity. But then so is your main character. So are several characters. In other words, the idea of other minds, other systems encroaching on your own just seems to run through the level of run through the novel at all kinds of levels.
It does. It is for me, Empire is identity all the way down.
Okay, yeah.
Like that's the thing that animates it, a universalization of identity, which is also a flattening.
Mm.
And it can, and in some historical cases has, have room for a great deal of multiplicity inside that greater flattening. You get things like the Pax Mongolica, where you have incredible amounts of cultural exchange between like Yuan China and the Ilkhanate, and get people inventing gunpowder and fireworks, and paper money moves back and forth very quickly in ways it would not have. And technical expertise, like in farming and the thing you do with aqueduct. There's a word for that. Public works. Building things. And that would not be possible without the kind of cultural flattening, which is everybody is subordinate to this sort of military, hyper-focused on the sworn band over culture. Mm-hmm. But that allows you to pass people back and forth when they're useful. I mean, this is specific to the Mongols, but that happens in quite a few imperial systems, is that you get a mobility of ideas and sometimes a mobility of people, including up and down a social ladder. But what you pay for that is pretty damn high. What you pay for that is a collapse of independent culture and a collapse of sort of the aesthetics of progress, would be how I might describe it. What counts as progress, what looks right, and that becomes only the thing that the imperial culture identifies as being real and being true. And that's always also what is theirs. So
in this space, where did you find Mahit? Because she is the thing that unlocks it all.
Mahit is a combination of things. So there's a historical story in Byzantium and Byzantium's relationship with medieval Armenia, which is what I spent my academic career studying, of the Catholicos of the Armenian Apostolic Church in the 11th century. His name was Petros Gethadaj. And for complex geopolitical reasons, he found it most useful to hand over sovereignty of an Armenian city to the Byzantines in exchange for not having to convert to their version of Christianity. And to not have to make the other Armenians convert to their version of Christianity. And that's a bargain that he made. And he was both enormously praised and enormously excoriated for it. We have both things in the historical record. He's remembered both as a traitor and as the savior of the Armenian church. So simultaneously. So originally, my conception for a protagonist was that guy. It's way more interesting to be the person who has to clean up after that guy.
But that guy is still there.
Well, yes, and that's the fun of science fiction.
And of course, a key part of it is that in this day and age, there is this classic kind of science fiction story, this retelling of Empire with queer protagonists with a whole different point of view. That seems to me, if you would ask me to characterize what's happening in science fiction in 2021, it's not neat new ideas with tech. It's the importance of change of perspective and point of view and inclusionist. How important was it casting that point of view into the story, having a queer romance relationship building through the story for you?
It was instinctive and not very much something I decided to do. This is in essence, I'm writing from life in this case. I myself am queer, and my friends and acquaintances and community are people of all sorts of genders and sexualities, but it's not a huge deal.
Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to do was write a book about homophobia, because I find them absolutely dull. And also the least interesting story you can tell about a queer person is a story about oppression. And I also wanted to unmark the queerness in my books as much as possible, because that let everyone who was in them be exactly as virtuous or villainous as they actually are, and have it not really be coded in any particular way. I'm one of those queer people who really wants us to write more queer villains because we are villainous too, and there are the whole range of human experience.
Yeah.
Happiness is ideal, but not something that is guaranteed. Anyway, that's a dynamic for another time.
I guess I hadn't thought about that until we were talking now. But I obviously noticed there are queer characters in it. There are characters who are clearly marked as female or male, but nobody's coded in any particular way. In other words, so there's a sense in which there's a kind of utopian sense in this, in which gender is not a social construct that controls anybody.
I think that of the many things that are oppressive about Texcalan and about LaSalle, gender isn't one of them. People have got gender to varying degrees, much as they do in the world we live in. And if it's a thing that's important to you, you spend a bunch of time on it, like people who really like doing their hair. I mean, I say this as someone who really likes doing her hair and who really likes having a gender, but like, it's not part of why people in these books are in trouble or talented or get involved in politics they really oughtn't have.
It does seem to me that Memory is at the beginning of a wave of books that we're seeing now that sit in exactly this space. That if you look at Kate Elliott's Unconquerable Sun, if you look at Shelley Parker Chan's She Who Became the Sun, books like that, there is this approach that you're talking about that seems to be, in the most useful way, I think, in altering viewpoint in science fiction in a way that's really healthy.
I agree with you. I think that there are a bunch of writers sort of from approximately my generation, in terms of age, so the late millennials, basically, who have come to the beginning of their real careers at the same time. And many of us share cultural commonalities that mean that we are addressing sociological issues in similar ways. I think it's a really interesting time to be writing.
I think what's also interesting about it, because I think you're completely correct, is that if you cast narratives as outsider narratives, then you take a peripheral position in things. All of these stories are taking, and Memory very much does, the core material and stuff of the genre and changing and influencing it. This is, if you like, core SF changing before our very eyes, I think.
I think that's true. And it gets back to that same thing of, well, why not have the central point? Why not have the stories that animate the deepest parts of my childhood and adolescent imagination center people who could have been me if I had been there?
Yeah.
Why not?
I'm curious.
I mean, this is not to say that I will never write a word.
I'm curious, going back to being a kid, being a 9-year-old reading Foundation, because let's face it, Asimov is not the most sensitive writer of character in the history of science fiction. And there's a lot of bad stuff about Asimov's personal behavior, which we cannot ignore. I mean, he was apparently absolutely horrible towards
not him. At all.
But the fact is that most of the characters in the Foundation novels are completely sexless, as far as I can. They're not gendered.
It works really well for a 9-year-old. Most 9-year-olds are also completely sexless.
Well, that's probably why it worked so well for a 9-year-old.
But also, you could go back and
rewrite the Foundation sequence and make all just distribute the characters among a range of sexualities and gender identities, and it wouldn't make any difference at all to what happens in those novels.
It wouldn't. No, it's not what it's about.
Exactly.
But then the Foundation novels aren't really about people. They're an argument.
No, they're an argument. And my argument has always been that they're not an argument about utopia. They're simply an argument about management. I mean, Asimov was a great management theorist, at least in his own mind. I'm sorry.
There's a dead stories there that I want now.
And yet when I think about it, it's like, I mean, Asimov is Asimov. I mean, I will say I'm fascinated to see how they're going to find story and character for Foundation in this TV adaptation they're doing, because there's no character in Asimov, right? But
he wrote some characters, but they've been done much better in fan fiction. The Ardennial books have characters.
Mm. Yeah.
But much better in fan fiction if you really want to read about those characters.
Oh, the robots are much better characters than the humans are, though. Daniel,
does it say something about Asimov or about science fiction?
Well, good point. I'm just in curiosity, because since you started reading, and you've had this interesting career, you grew up reading science fiction, you had a distinguished academic career, which you've now moved on from to some extent. How does it feel to go from being a young reader of science fiction to kind of being at the center of the field? You know, you're in Hugo Awards, you've written two major novels, everybody wants to see what you're doing. You've moved from the outside to the inside.
It was a very deliberate campaign. which is not to say that I ever thought I would win Hugo Awards this early. I really didn't. I was pleased and gratified to be nominated and extremely surprised to win. But in the sense of moving from being that kid to being who I am now, I wanted to write books and short stories so that I could talk to other authors and critics and people who really did this as at least a junior colleague. Because otherwise you're just, like, for me, fandom is not a comfortable place to stay.
I can see.
If I really want to get to know people, or get to know stories that people have created. I can't come to a favorite author and say, I want to sit down and talk about like how you did this craft-wise and not have my own bona fides. And maybe I could, but internally it's very difficult for me. So I remember quite distinctly thinking, all right, if I want to be part of that conversation and be taken seriously, I better get good. I better get good really fast. Then I worked on it.
But winning awards is a really strange thing, not least because you've got no overt control over it. You'd write the best book of the decade and not win. How did winning the Hugo for Memory change how you feel or impact how you feel about your writing and about the stories you're telling?
I think it confirms for me that I can be as complicated as I like to be. Because if a book as lyrical and emotionally strange and in some ways deeply, deeply an academic argument of my own, as Memory can win a popular genre award, then all right, I have an audience for that. I can keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm fascinated.
That's a good thing.
I will say as well, listening to you talk about reading and your career, the thought that does occur to me is you grew up to be Harry Seldon, didn't you?
Oh, for fuck's sake, I didn't realize that until just this minute. Ah. a bit, yeah. I mean, I work in public policy now, and it's the happiest I've ever been career-wise, aside from writing, which I consider to be a simultaneous career. I don't really think of one as the day job and one as the not day job. They're both the things I do, and I'm deadly serious about both of them. They both matter a huge amount to me. But a multitude of my friends have said, it took you so long to figure out you wanted to work in politics. And I'm just like, oh God, really? Yeah, it was obvious. It should have been obvious earlier.
Well, given your job, I would not be at all surprised to see you writing near future science fiction. I mean, you're living in near future policy right now.
Yep. And the novella that I have just finished is about architecture and artificial intelligence, basically. And the book I'm writing now is about arson and wildfires and water politics. So yeah, it's what I do every day, but that's how I got Memory and Desolation too. It's what I was doing every day for a decade. So it all feeds into itself.
How attractive is it to write stories set in the far distant future as compared to the present day, just because of the insane complexity of attempting to write about present day?
Extremely. I think I said at some point in an interview, which I no longer remember where I said it, but when I was talking about writing Desolation, which I was in the middle of doing at the time, that it was important to me to challenge myself with every book to learn something new, especially because I'd come so late to novel writing.
Yeah.
My wife, Vivian Shaw, who is the author of the Greta Helsing books, she's been writing novels since she was 11. I mean, they were shorter when she was 11, but they were novels and they were like 25,000 words. which is quite long for an 11-year-old.
Sure.
And it took me till I was nearly 30 to write a complete novel. And I still feel very much like I am learning how. So to get from memory to desolation, the challenge I set for myself was, can I write the pacing for multiple points of view?
Yeah.
As opposed to having one and working very, very closely within one mind. And the challenge I have set for myself in the book I'm working on now, which is called Prescribed Burn, until someone tells me it's not, is can I lose the crutch of disconnect between the present moment and where I'm writing? Can I drop that? And can I still pull off the story, giving myself that extra constraint of keeping the logic whole?
Also, you can't have that same kind of epic kind of feel, because there's something that a space opera, if it ever wasn't, is still very much is an epic fantasy kind of story. Big, wide, sweeping, dramatic, colorful. Near future science fiction, well, is the universe we're living in with the Gulf Stream shutting down and the world on fire. And that, for all of its drama, just is completely different. It is an infinite series of personal apocalypses rather than anything else. And so it's got to be a very different feel to try to tell those stories.
I have different models. I leave Cherry and Herbert, and in some ways, well, I keep Elizabeth Baer because Elizabeth Baer does both things.
Yeah, she does.
But I go to Gibson and Raymond Chandler, and that's where I am with this book. It's me trying to do a William Gibson novel, except as an Arkady Martin novel. but that's where I found the way in, was to think about the intense and brilliant focus that Gibson, especially in the Pattern Recognition trilogy, the Blue Ant trilogy, uses with objects, the ephemera of culture, and how that very much roots a culture in a time and a place, and the fluidity with which people use that ephemera tells you almost everything you need to know about them as people. I taught a class on voice for Clarion West recently and had people take apart the beginning of Zero History, just the first scene, and try to find what the voice is, like what is it doing? Not the character, but the selection of the authorial voice to give you the atmosphere. And it is an absolute focus on the interaction between the character and the objects in the world.
I can see where Chandler fits into that too. Because you totally,
this thing for my enormous sins is set in Los Angeles. I'm a New Yorker. I don't know why I've done this to myself.
Which must make the research challenging in the current day.
Yeah.
Getting back and forth.
Well, the Los Angeles 5 or 10 or 20 years from now probably will be as unrecognizable to Los Angelinos as it will be to New Yorkers. So what difference does it make?
Fair enough. And I'm going farther ahead than that.
Okay.
I'm about 150
years. One of the things, I remember talking to Stan Robinson when he had written his Science in the Capital trilogy. And one of the things, I don't know if he's actually changed it, one of those novels actually has the Gulf Stream shutting down. And then a couple of years after that, maybe 5-10 years after the novel came out, scientists discovered that the Gulf Stream wasn't really shutting down after all. So he revised that, I think. He can correct me. And now it turns out the Gulf Stream is shutting down again. So no matter what you say about the future, Gibson is so cheerful about the things he got wrong in Neuromancer, and none of it affects the experience of the novel at all. It's a world with no self.
And that's the ideal for me, is to spin a convincing future, one that has its own cultural weight.
Well, go ahead, Jonathan.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that one of the things that I've always been fascinated about with Gibson was a story of his called The Gernsback Continuum, in which the pulp vision of the future somehow, sustains itself out in the desert. It's great. But the weird thing is that Gibson's 1984 future in Neuromancer is now its own Gernsback Continuum. People can enter that world, and you read Neuromancer, and you don't think, oh, he missed cell phones. You think, this is a world complete unto itself, just like those globular cities were back in the 30s.
It's one universe or two over.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all.
Exactly.
How was it? Sorry. I was going to say, how was it at the, you've finished writing Empire, you've talked about the structure of what you were going to do with Desolation, but how was it trying to find the story and the pace and the ending that you wanted to bring it to in Desolation?
Horrible would be an answer. I had Mahit's arc from the beginning. I didn't have the actual ending for quite a ways into the book. I knew where Mahit ended up, which meant that she had to live, though very little else had to be true. And I knew what my inciting problem was, and I had spent quite a bit of time thinking about my aliens, so I knew how they worked functionally.
Yeah.
But I wrote it the way I write almost everything, which is to blindly throw things into the air and hope that I'm there to catch them when they come down. For about the first 40%, upon which I've built up enough substrate and saturated the solution sufficiently that it starts growing plot crystals all by itself. And then I can prune some and encourage some to grow. But it was very, very difficult to figure out how to balance the tension, especially because I ended up with three of my four point of view characters in the same location. And one of them quite a ways away, and on a time lag. And the time lag I knew from the beginning was important to the resolution. I actually had some of Eight Antidotes' plot from the moment I started it, including the he will commit interstellar mail fraud and it will matter, because I thought it was too fun not to. But I did not know who would do the thing that I have Swarm do in the book. I knew someone needed to do that at some point. I didn't know who, because I hadn't invented him when I started writing. He showed up on about page three and then was vastly interesting, and I briefly considered giving him point of view and then decided that would be cheating.
So a lot of writing sounds like it's casting off into the great unknown with a few ideas of what you'll find in the murk out there and then seeing what it becomes.
For me, yes. I'm a thematic-oriented writer. I know how a story feels from beginning to end before I start writing it. I know what it is about. I almost always have no idea how I'm going to get there or pull it off. People who outline amaze me. I don't know how they do it. How do you make those decisions without putting in the tone? Like, how can you decide what happens next without knowing what words you've used in the previous chapter? This occasionally drives co-writers of mine up the wall. I'm just like, I don't need to know that now. It just, it's cool. I'll put it in. We'll do something. Oh, God, you're really, really annoying.
Well, I guess that's the thing. I don't think I've particularly seen a lot of co-written short fiction with you, but that you've done. But do you find that that kind of collaboration experience changes how you think about your writing?
Absolutely, it does. I have a half-written novel that I'm co-writing with my wife. And that comes out of we met through writing, and we write together all the time. And eventually we decided, well, this story is really good. Maybe we could like polish it up and see if we could make it a real one that other people could read.
Sure.
But it teaches me a ton about how I think about writing, not necessarily how I write, but how I think about it and how I describe it.
And is that because you have to explain to someone else?
That so that someone else can understand what I was trying to do is difficult, and I think highly person dependent. I'm not sure I'd be as willing to try it with someone I didn't like so much.
But I mean, I do think it's an interesting thing that sometimes you only find out what you're doing when you're forced to explain it to another person.
It's like teaching.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Could you have imagined having written anything other than science fiction?
No. I end up writing science fiction unless I'm trying really hard not to. I have written some fantasy. I will probably write some at the short fiction length. I will probably at some point try to do it at novel length. I'm interested in whether I can. I have a suspicion that I will land in poor man's Shadow of the Torturer sort of scenario where it's actually science fiction underneath everything, because that kind of, I don't know, depth of mystery is what I end up gravitating towards in fantasy,
which is what
I read.
That's why Gene Wolfe called it science fantasy, which is a term that kind of went out of favor, but it used to be around quite a bit, Fritz Leiber and Jack Vance, things that are, as you described your own novels, things that are set so far in the future and so far away that they can be read as fantasy. They don't make really demands on the reader that near future science fiction makes where we have mm-hmm. to draw the lines. So it's you don't think you could have written Memory or Desolation as fantasy novels?
Someone else could have.
Okay.
I couldn't.
Good answer.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
I think that I would have run myself into a wall, both for the reason I already mentioned about the historicism is difficult to do to a level that I find acceptable for me. And I don't have this problem really reading other people's. It's just when I'm writing it, I can't do it wrong.
In a way, that's not too different from what Gene's attitude was when he was writing the Book of the New Sun and the Book of the Long Sun and that sort of thing. That from his point of view, this is just a conversation we had years ago, writing something like The Wizard Knight, which sets out to be fantasy, was more unmoored because at least when he's writing his far future, he knows what the sort of cosmology is. And it's essentially our cosmology. When you're in fantasy, you're not even in the same cosmology.
I think that's why there's so much emphasis amongst people whose native language is fantasy in doing enormous amounts of pre-world building. Mm-hmm. That gives you the architecture to hang the story on. It's also probably why I don't write fantasy, because doing all of that work beforehand seems like a lot of work.
I'm curious, you've successfully published two novels so far. You have more coming. Has that changed how you read science fiction now that you are you are doing that?
Annoyingly, yes. I am no longer a naive reader and cannot be. Mm-hmm. I probably wasn't one. I haven't been one for a long time. Sure. But it's become very obvious to me that I cannot turn off the part of my brain that notices how people do things when they are writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a thing that means that I don't enjoy it or mm-hmm. read it with, I'm not doing critique, but yeah. I can't not notice craft. And I never had a very high tolerance for prose that didn't work for me. And now I have a negative tolerance for prose that doesn't work for me. I will simply stop reading books very quickly, which I'm somewhat embarrassed about, but is true.
Is that partly just you get a visceral realization that everything that's put there is a choice and could be done differently. And mm-hmm. once there you're going, I look at the story choice and I question that for various reasons, but I also now look at the word choice, the fact that you could have gone back and fixed that, the fact that this arc could work properly, the fact that that thing there is kind of objectionable. Those sorts of things are no longer just things you experience. I mean, I remember the first moment when I realized that books were written by humans as opposed to just being things, right? It sounds like a silly thing to say, but I mean, I remember viscerally, like, books appeared in your life and they were there. And yes, they had author names on them, but that didn't mean there was a human walking around with that name on them. They were just these things. And then there was a human making choices.
Yeah. And quite often I will read, whether or not I like it, I will read a book where I know that the choice is deliberate, even if it's not a choice I'm enjoying.
Yeah.
An author who's in control of the choices they're making with prose, with plot, with character, has got me for a hell of a lot longer than one who doesn't.
Yes.
And this is most obvious for me for prose, because it's just like, well, if you're going to write transparent prose, it has to be really transparent and you have to mean it. Otherwise, yes. It's just dull.
Also, if you're going to write lyrical prose, it has to actually be melodic. It can't be boom, absolutely. Boom.
Someday I will write something that is worthy of Gormenghast. In some ways, that's the end goal. Can I write something that is a William Gibson story in the voice of Mervyn Peake? If I can pull that off, maybe I'll have a career.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mention that, because in a way you're facing some of the same kind of decisions that Zelazny faced throughout his career, where he was, he was an extremely wildly lyrical writer at the beginning of his career. He and Delaney and Le Guin and a few others were just stylistically the fireworks of the 60s. But then when he found that he could write fantasy in a hard-boiled voice and the Amber Things, it just became really easy to him. And it was a deliberate choice at the beginning. It was an artistic choice. And then as I'm mentioning this because a book in my series that I'm editing for University of Illinois, I'll put a plug in. Brett Cox has written a good book about Zolas. And at some point, an artistic choice becomes an economic choice, I guess, if you become successful with one thing.
Or a habitual one.
I
think it's possible to write yourself into a voice and then get stuck.
Right.
I know that because, so I absolutely love the works of Stephen King.
Mm.
I think they're brilliant in terms of character and voice and 90% of the time plot, even though he's terrible at endings. But I love them. I will read them like candy. I can't write my own stuff without a good 12 hours and hopefully sleeping in between, because I will sound like a bad version of him. It's that catching. Voice is catching, which is why I think it's teachable. Like if you can catch voice, if you can catch tonality, then you can teach it. Then you could get someone who isn't good at it to be better at it.
And not be a parody of it. I mean,
fascinating.
It starts with parody, and then you figure out why.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, when you look at the number of people who have tried to write like him, and when you're tried to write like Chandler, I mean, both great writers who had horrible influences on subsequent generations.
Like, if you actually sit down with Chandler, there's a couple of those iconic lines, like, what I had was a coat, a hat, and a gun. I put it on and I left the room. And that's gorgeous. Like, but and iconic. And if you try to imitate that, if all of your prose sounds like that, you're going to sound hilarious. But if you look at the rest of what he's doing, the intense observation of place, and very small, he doesn't spend a lot of time on it. But he'll describe rain. He'll describe what someone ate as a character choice, and with a truly visceral adjective, and often quite out of place and quite surprising. And it's incredibly skilled. There's just no extraneous anything to it. And that's the trick. And that's the hard part. And I have not yet figured out how to do it as well. And I don't know if I ever will, but it's fun trying.
So do you see paring things back being the path forward?
I want to have it in my arsenal so that I can choose what I'm doing.
Well, you'd mentioned Le Carré when we were talking about the first drafts, I guess, the first versions of Memory. And as I say, the plotting, apart from, well, actually Chandler's plots, they always added up, but it took a long time to get there sometimes. But the classic espionage plot, I mean, Le Carré's plots are just perfectly elegant. They fit together like clockwork, even though you don't see it while it's happening. And as I said, that Le Carré novel is still in there somewhere. Do you have any indication to move in that direction?
Tons. I love spies and spy work anyway, which should be obvious from what I've already written. But I really enjoy the deeply unreliable narrator that is on top of a unreliable narration, which is on top of an unreliable character. So you've got the person telling the story and then the author telling you what you should look at, which is a misdirection. And
or the narrator who doesn't know he's unreliable. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, the clockwork's the right word for it. But it's clockwork like one of those skeleton watches where it's got 400 jewels.
Oh yeah, it's not Agatha Christie clockwork. It's not just snapping together. It's all the character, the language, the atmosphere, the setting, all those things seem to have a point which you don't necessarily realize until you build your way into the reading of the novel.
That's that Gestalt thing again.
Yeah, exactly.
When you get to the end of the whole book assembles, right, and you know what you saw.
Well, we're reaching the top of the hour, so we should probably get to the point where we let you return to your normal life. But I should say that Memory Called Empire is out, Desolation Called Peace is out, and if listeners have not read them, they should. They are fabulous novels.
But there's a new novella called Peace is not out in paperback yet, is it, or is it?
It is not out in paperback. It will be out in paperback next year.
Next year.
I believe in March next year in paperback.
Yes. You have to remember it's a 2021 book. I mean, as I was saying before we started, I read it last year, so it feels further in the past than it is for the rest of the world. You have a new novella coming out, I think, from Subterranean Press next year.
From Subterranean. It's called Rose House. I think it's mid-year 23. is my current guess.
And anything sort of after that will be into 2023 in the future, I assume.
I'm hoping that Prescribed Burn will be a 24 book.
24.
But I have to finish it. So.
Well, with all that out there, thank you so much for making time to talk to us today. It's been wonderful. I really appreciate it.
This is an absolute delight. Anytime you guys want to talk, I'm more than happy to come back.
We will totally take you up on that then. But until that happens, this has been the Coon Street Podcast.